This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 399 was produced on October 26, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Saxo Bank Commodities Chief Ola Hansen returns as this week's feature interview guest. Ola says the bull market has paused in some commodities, but it's set to continue. We'll also talk about crude oil and the debate over how big the Iran escalation risk is in the Israel conflict.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, October 25th, 2023. The S&P 500 futures were down 306 basis points, closing at 4209. We are trading at new multi-month lows, critical to watch what happens next. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in our post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 2 basis points to 106.54. The dollar continues to trade along its multi-month highs, but will we get the breakout to new highs in the post-ECB period? We will see. The WTI crude oil futures for the December contract down 215 basis points to 85.39. We'll take a look at that chart in the post-game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The RBOB gasoline December contract down 258 basis points to 227. The December gold contract up 142 basis points to 1996. Extraordinary rebound from the September sell-off, getting the prices back towards the summer highs. Copper flat on the week at 359, continuing to consolidate along the 52-week lows, and uranium up 446 basis points to 73.75, clearly attempting another bullish breakout to new year highs. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 5 basis points, closing at 496 points, a material breakout in yields now testing that critical 5% level. The key news to watch this week is Friday's core PCE price index and the revised University of Michigan consumer sentiment numbers. Next week, we have the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and the FOMC monetary policy statements, the jobs numbers, and the ISM manufacturing and services PMIs. Now, this week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank Commodities Chief Ole Hansen. Eric, why do we get Ole back on the show as a guest this week?
Patrick, commodities are hot. I do think that we're in a bullish commodity super cycle. I think it is a time to focus more on commodity markets than equity markets. And it, clearly, Ole Hansen is one of the best experts in the industry for that subject. It's also very timely given the Israel situation, very similar to Dr. Anas Al-Haji's view last week. Ola disagrees with me and thinks that the risk of escalation with Iran is much lower than I think. So we'll cover that as well.
Eric's interview with Ole Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Saxo Bank's commodity chief, Ole Hansen. Ola prepared a slide deck to accompany this interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads above Ola's picture. Ola, it's great to get you back. I'm really looking forward to diving into your slide deck. I love the 747 on the splash page there. But let's dive into slide number 2.
Well, let's do that, Eric. And first of all, thank you very much for inviting me back. It's obviously a continued, a very interesting time to be involved in the commodity sector, for good or bad, and movements are seen everywhere. But let's start with the conclusion first. Basically, our view is that the commodity supercycle is still alive. It's much driven by tight supply than it is by demand. And I think we're seeing that also unfolding across some of these key commodities right now. We've had a significant correction, as we can see on the slide. Bloomberg's spot index is correcting almost half the gain since the low in 2020, but has started to recover somewhat during the past 3 months. And actually, so far this quarter is looking quite promising. But I've highlighted some of the reasons why we believe that the commodity sector will continue to be supported, and simply because in some cases prices are not high enough in order to attract the production that is required for some of the targets and future goals to aspirations to be met. I mentioned some of them, and I think the one we are seeing in full flow right now is the fragmentation game that has been ongoing now for a number of years. We're seeing production being reshored and French short. It's having a quite significant positive impact on the US economy, but it's also helping to drive up prices, because it's no longer necessarily where the price are the cheapest that they are being produced. So that's having impact. The green transformation, we all know. And I think the structural inflation is one that we cannot ignore. We are seeing and I got a slide later on just showing how the forward inflation expectations are already starting to pick up again. So we're not going to settle at the FOMC's or the Fed's long-term inflation target. We may dip, but it's not going to be where we eventually settle. We're seeing that will support commodities. And then we have tight supply. We've seen that in the, obviously, crude oil market right now due to political motivated decisions to keep production tight. But we're also seeing it elsewhere across the food commodities and some of the mined metals as well.
Moving on to page 3, let's talk about inflation. I have a view that we are in a new structural inflation. Is that your view? And tell us a little bit about the charts.
Absolutely. And as shown here, this is the 5-year forward inflation swap. And what we've just seen recently is last week, it just briefly hit the highest level since 2015. We're pretty close to that level. And that basically the markets is telling us where they believe 5-year inflation will be in 5 years' time. And we can see that that's obviously not in the 2% area where the Fed has its long-term target. I think at the same time, we're also watching the SOFR contracts, which these are the SOFR contracts replaced the old Eurodollar 3 month contracts that were traded in the open outcry pits in Chicago in the old days and then went electronic. And now it's the SOFR contracts that really dictates the movements in the short end of the curve. And what we've seen just so far this month is really two things. First of all, the expectations for how low interest rates will go before they eventually start to pick up again. That has moved up by more than 30 basis points. So now the low point you can see here, that's a blue line from just recently. It does indicate we are going to have a through around higher than 4.1%. That was below 4 at the start of the month. And also that low point has moved closer. The market's pricing in a period of rate cuts, but then eventually we'll start to pick up again. And part of that story is simply that market is getting around to the idea that inflation is not going to come down to where we were hoping it to see it, but it will structurally be at a higher level, and the short-term interest rate market has to reflect that as well.
Moving on to page 4, let's talk about which commodities are performing well, which are not, and why.
Yeah, exactly. And this is just showing the second half. We all know that there was some weakness during the first half, but the second half so far is one of generally of strength. We can see the energy sector is out there in front, and some of that has really been mostly happening during the first part of this second half, because this month, even though we have the crisis in the Middle East, we've got the energy sector actually down in the month. We got the refinery margins coming down. We got diesel and then the gasoline prices coming down as well, because we're entering into the low demand part of the season, and that's helping to offset some of the risk that we have associated with the war in between Israel and Hamas right now. But generally, as you can see, it's the energy sector that's been leading. And then we got the soft sector, which is just, we got some of these markets on fire. Orange juice, I haven't even put it in here because it just breaks the scale. It's up more than 100% this year. We got cocoa prices trading at the highest level since I was a young kid. I don't remember exactly what chocolate was trading back in 1978, but I was there. So that's a 44-year high in cocoa prices. Sugar, 12-year high. Coffee has had a very strong recovery this past month. So there's something happening there as well, and that's weather-related. And then generally, precious metals starting to pick up very strongly, but so far it's primarily it's not firing on all cylinders. So far, it's primarily been a gold-driven rally across the precious metal space. But as you see, all the weakness that we saw starting to be reversed, some of that due to demand, some of that, and quite a lot of it due to supply issues.
I'm curious about orange juice being up more than 100%. I wasn't aware of that. Is that a weather-related thing, or what's causing that?
Well, the orange tree seems to be disappearing in Florida. There's been diseases, there's been some storms. Basically, the production in Florida, I can't remember the numbers now, but just it's a fraction of where it was a couple of decades ago. So it's primarily a drop in U.S. production. So the old Trading Places film from the was it the 80s? That's really back in focus with orange juice prices at these very, very elevated levels.
Ola, if you were to ask me what is the one thing about commodities that most finance professionals, other than commodity people, just don't get or kind of misunderstand, it's the point you're about to make on the next two slides. So listeners, pay attention because this is super important to understand. Hit us up with why backwardation, structural backwardation, is so important to long investors in commodities.
Simply because all the activity in the commodity market starts in the futures market. The futures curve is a pricing expectation for well, it's pricing what the market is, what a given commodity is worth for immediate delivery, and what people are prepared to pay it at a forward date. And this basically creates either a curve that's backward sloping, which is backwardation, and or upward sloping, which is contango. For a number of years, we've had a market where the market has been well supplied. We had that almost throughout the last decade, up until around 2018-19. Ample supply been led by the very strong rallies we had in commodities after the financial crisis, led by China. That triggered a lot of investments. We saw the rush into oil production in the US. So basically, we had ample supply. So market was trading contango. Spot prices were cheap because producers were trying to offload their production. This has changed in recent years, and right now we're actually seeing quite a few commodities in backwardation, meaning that the spot price is the highest on the curve. Why is that important from an investment perspective? Well, it is because if you are buying either a futures market or you're buying an ETF that tracks the underlying or tracks the futures market, you will incur a roll on a regular basis. In the oil markets, it's once a month. And obviously, if we're in a backwardation, the provider of the ETF, or if you hold this futures market contract yourself, you'll be selling high and buying the next one at a lower price. That is giving you a return, a roll yield, which is which when you accumulate that will have quite a positive impact on your return. You can see on the right-hand side there, I've just highlighted some of the changes over the last 3 months. And if we take some of the contracts with the biggest backwardation right now, it's heating oil and it's gas oil and it's crude oil, WTI. It has come down a little bit since. But basically, what it means that if you're buying crude oil today and you expect unchanged price in a year's time, you would make 10% plus. If you're looking at heating oil or the ULSD contract, if you buy it today and expecting unchanged price in a year's time, then that backwardation basically means that the price a year out will move towards the spot level, and that will give you a return closer to 15%. And that really is a significant factor. Also, I think it's worth mentioning that what is the cost of holding a position for a year? Well, the main cost normally is the cost of financing. And for years, the cost of finance was close to zero because US money was free. Now, the 1 year cost of borrowing money is a bit more than 5% if you just look at T-bill rates. And that basically means any commodity that trades above that red line there, you can almost say that they're in backwardation, because if everything else was equal, then all the commodities would be at least be around that five negative 5%, because that's the cost of holding a position for a year. And that's also why gold and silver and some of the metals, they all cost around 5% to hold for, a little bit more than that to hold for a year, simply because the cost of holding position. And that's a key element in why we're seeing some of the investment appetite not being strong in gold, but we can come to that. And as you said, there's two slides in this section. And just to give you an idea about the return on slide six, if you look at the five-year return on using the Bloomberg Commodity Index, we could have used others as well, but the Bloomberg Commodity I like because it's roughly one-third in energy, metals, and agriculture. If you bought an ETF tracking the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index in that five-year return or five-year period, you are looking at a return of 46%. But if you look at the total return, basically taking the roll into account, then suddenly your return has collapsed to just 5%. So basically, no one, it's not someone has out been out stealing your money, or the ETF was just punitively expensive to buy. It's simply the roll cost that, instead of giving you 46%, gave you only 5%. Fast forward to the past couple of years, from 2021 up until now, we can see how this completely flipped around. The spot index tells you that the spot price of the market has moved up around 29%, but the actual return, if you held an ETF tracking that index, you would have made close to 45%. that is a major shift, and that's why investments into commodities have started to pick up and become more popular. And we can see that actually if we just stay on the theme on slide 7, this is just some of the major ETFs. Obviously, there's a tons of different ETFs tracking underlying futures markets, but I just split them into two sections. There are some we can't trade in Europe and some we can, but you can see those that are highlighted in green. These are basically broad exposure ETFs, and you can see that's where most of the activity has come in, the flows has come in over the past 3 months. So investors are looking for broad exposure in commodities. One of the reasons is the tightness. Another reason is and that obviously leads to this roll yield that you're getting.
It's such an important point, Ola, because, you know, I'll hear macro people talk about, you know, in this environment, I really like, you know, gold is a better investment than oil. And I say, wait a minute, do you realize that if you're going to go long gold, you've got to make $112 in a year of upside in order to break even, because that's the contango you're fighting. But if you buy oil instead, the price can go down a little bit, and you still make money, even though the price went down, because you're capturing all of that roll yield. It seems to me like if you imagine a fixed income guy, the buying and selling bonds, ignoring the 10% coupon, the people that trade commodities through ETFs who don't understand this mechanism, it's like they're ignoring the coupon on the bond. It's amazing to me how many people don't really understand this. And since we're on the topic of gold, why don't I get your comments on that as well?
And I think that's a good segue, Eric, simply because you just mentioned that the cost of carry and the contango in the gold market. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we have seen gold to a certain extent, on one point being a little bit of out of favor from ETF investors. On slide 8, in the bottom right-hand corner, I'm just giving you the movements in ETF holdings and real yields. And real yields obviously has been going up quite strongly. And that's also as the funding cost has been going up, the 1 year, as we talked about earlier, which was more than 5%. So the rising cost of funding has basically meant that if you're an asset manager and you're looking for gold as an investment, you like gold, but at the same time you're facing that wall to climb in terms of being the funding of holding a position, you're basically in no hurry. You're looking for a change in the outlook before you really start to get involved. And that's basically meant that the holdings in ETFs has been on a downward slope since 2021. It really accelerated, I would say, this during the past 3 to 4 months, and only now showing signs of stabilizing. Because asset managers, I think they're looking for one thing, and they're looking for a peak in rates. They're looking for that funding to start to come down. Either that, or they're looking for a move in the price, which basically simply forced them to get into the market. But I think also the gold market is telling us a completely different story. I know all the story, I know all the headlines we see now for the past week. Gold is rallying on safe haven buying. I'm not buying that. Safe haven, yes, probably kicked it off. But what it did kick off was a massive amount of short covering, because just before the October 7th attack on Israel, we actually had money managers holding a short position in gold simply because the outlook was fading somewhat, with a high for longer thesis taking hold, and suddenly we had a turnaround. So the safe haven buying was triggered the short covering that started, and then that really carried on. But when you look at on the right hand side there, the discrepancy between gold, the dollar, and especially gold and real yields, you can see there's most certainly something else going on. And I think what that something else is simply the fact that rising yields for a while has been gold negative, but I think actually they've started to become gold positive, because rising yields just creates bigger and bigger problems, because there's some massive losses out there, which I think the market is starting to get worried about. Just take a look at the major banks this year in the US banks. Citigroup down 40% in Morgan Stanley, down 14%, 16% in Morgan Stanley. We got Bank of America down 23%. They are at the lows of the year. This is some of the worries that the market may have. So I think gold right now, rising yields is gold supportive, simply because it creates concerns about something breaking somewhere else. And that's why I think we're seeing this major discrepancy between gold and real yields recently. So again, question, can it continue? Maybe not. Maybe we've seen most of it already. And maybe we need to see real yields start to come down. And I think they will come down when the inflation story starts to take hold, and we get confirmation that we have seen peak rates, because If you look at slide 9, we have seen peak rates 3 times now in the past 20 years. And every time that peak rate has been followed by very strong moves up in gold. And just looking at ETF and asset managers' involvement, there's a lot of ammunition that could be sent back into the gold market if when we get that peak rate confirmation and we get potentially get some concerns about the economic health elsewhere. So we maintain a, as we call it, patient bullish outlook for gold. And if we do take out that high from the triple top, then I think we won't see much in terms of resistance before we move $250 to $300 higher.
Ola, let's talk a little bit more about peak rates. I agree with you, and I think the general consensus, that once we get to peak nominal rates and the market knows that the top is in, it's probably a launch point for gold to the upside. But hang on a second. I'm a lot more skeptical than a lot of market participants about this idea that, oh, surely we're almost at peak rates. I mean, we've been saying that for how many years? And everybody thought maybe the 10-year could get as high as 3%, but unlikely. Well, guess what? We're not quite double that yet, but we're kind of heading in that direction.
Absolutely. And that is still the big thing. But I think at the same time, all the comments we had from central bankers during the past month leading up to next month's FOMC meeting, they've all been talking about the market's been doing the job for them, i.e. the rising interest rates we've seen at the long end of the bond market has helped tighten up the market. I just wonder if they're sending that signal because they are worried about something that they can't tell us. So maybe a little bit of a, not conspiracy, but just maybe some concerns that there are other and bigger issues that may become the focus. So I think that's probably my reason for not seeing rates going much higher, even though the underlying economics should dictate that we should see higher rates. But I think also simply the fact that we've had these rate hikes has been, just looking at that right hand side on slide 9, that just the phenomenal pace of this rate hike has been so aggressive that we only now really starting to see the impact of those hikes. And I think there's reasonably room for them to at least pause for now. If the aggression of these hikes and the high mortgage high rates we've seen now at the long end, I mean, it's a US, as far as I can see, US mortgage rate is now close to 8% if you have a long-term loan. This will be felt, and I think they'll probably see that happening over the coming months. So I think we are very close to a peak, simply because the impact of these hikes has yet really to filter through to the economy.
Let's move on to page 10 and industrial base metals. I see you've got a lot of emphasis on this slide on energy transition. Robert Friedland told me that he doesn't believe it's possible for energy transition to occur as it's planned because there literally is not enough copper, and it's just that simple. Is he right about that? And which other metals, you know, battery metals and so forth? It seems like we really haven't thought through what it's going to take to pull this off.
That is, I think that's an absolute fair point, and that's also our main reason for staying medium to long term very bullish on copper, simply because these prices are way too low to attract the amount of production that is required. I mean, there's a lot of focus right now, obviously, on the rollout of the electrical vehicles. It's going really fast. We do note here in Scandinavia that we get very cheap electrical vehicles because it's not the whole of Europe that's jumped onto this EV bandwagon. So they're dumping their cars in Scandinavia. So that's nice for us for the time being. But the EV rollout will obviously continue to accelerate. A lot of people, myself included, I have a reasonably old car. I'm just sitting on the fence because I don't really want to buy a new combustion engine car, and I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of EVs. But another one is actually providing, having a grid that can provide all the electricity that is going to be required in the years to come. IEA came out with some numbers the other day. They're pretty nonsense because the amount of kilometers that need to be put down every day is, I couldn't quite work that one out. But nevertheless, demand for copper will remain strong. Current prices are not high enough, but current prices are a reflection of the slowdown that we're seeing in the short term here, not only in China where the property market is still under pressure, but also the rest of the world. But at the same time, I think it's worth pointing out that the inventory levels are really low. You can see that on the insert there on slide 10. We have seen a pickup in copper inventories recently, but I think part of that is simply due to the fact that cost of financing and holding a position right now is so high with the interest rates at these levels. So a lot of these metals are just being pushed onto the exchange, and that's why we're seeing increased number of inventories. So it's not necessarily because it's not in demand, but simply because investors don't want to sit on it. They want to pass it on and they'll take it out when they need it. So low inventories combined with the transition is a supportive factor in the coming years. Copper, aluminium, probably the two major ones when it comes to support. And I think also at the same time, we are seeing miners. Now we're into the earnings season, so it'll be interesting to see what they have to say in terms of their challenges. But the last quarter, they were all talking about high input prices, diesel, electric, and labor, lower ore grades, regulatory costs on the up, climate change, too much water, too little water, and so on. So they're faced with a lot of challenges in the coming years to achieve the kind of production levels that we believe will be required. So again, a long-term bullish story for the industrial metals.
One of the reasons that I'm extremely long-term bullish on copper is because, to my knowledge, there basically is no replacement for transmitting electricity. I mean, there is a replacement, which is aluminum, which costs more and is also very expensive to produce. So are you aware of any developmental, you know, research laboratory stuff that there's anything at all on the horizon that might be a replacement or a substitute for copper and aluminum as electrical conductors?
Not yet. And as you mentioned, aluminium is one, but its ability over long distances is not great. So what can alleviate some of these pressures is smart applications, that the available electricity at any given time gets utilized to the max, basically meaning that whenever there's a low in regular uses of power, that's when all the charges kicks in. So that obviously can, if you can even out the consumption of electricity throughout the 24 hours, not only the 2 hours in the evening when you put on your kettle and you start your washing machine and then turn the telly on, then obviously that could alleviate some of the pressure. But generally, electricity demand will continue to rise, and that basically means it needs to be transported, and that's still copper. That's the main conductant for that.
Let's move on now to crude oil on page 11.
Yes, and I think we can have an interesting discussion here, because what I'm seeing here in the crude oil market is obviously a market that where traders simply don't really know what leg to stand on. We are in a bit of a flux in terms of geopolitical risks. Market is trying to price in a war premium or the risk of a disruption. So far, that premium seems to be capped at around $5, and it gets given back to the market almost before it gets built up. And it just highlights the market struggling with a not yet realized disruption. Also, it's happening at a time where we are seeing refinery margins coming down. So we are heading into the seasonal period where demand tends to weaken. So if refinery margins come down, then obviously refineries will reduce their demand for crude oil, will suffer somewhat as well, and that will make more available. I mentioned the spare capacity here on slide 11 as a key reason why I think prices will struggle to break significantly higher. We have the geopolitical risk, and obviously that could be a complete game changer. But spare capacity and rising spare capacity in the past has generally not been associated with higher prices, simply because the ability to meet a disruption goes up. But at the same time, we also see that most of that spare capacity is basically the GCC countries in the Middle East. And again, if we do have a flare-up in the Middle East, which I doubt will happen, but we can discuss, then that some of that spare capacity will not be able to be released and offset disruptions elsewhere. So if we set aside the geopolitical risk just for now, then I think the only thing we know for sure is that there is a floor. There's probably has been a floor established in the market when Saudi Arabia has been prepared to give up yield revenues in order to support prices by cutting production. Then it does tell me that there is an area there in the 75 to 80 bracket in Brent, obviously a bit lower in WTI, that will be defended tooth and nail. And I think that's the only thing that's probably a relative certain right now, but whether the upside is capped here at 95 or whether we are going to see a spike higher, that really is all depends on the availability of supply. Speculators right now, they are not buying into this geopolitical risk. We've seen some pretty interesting movements recently, but generally they do not point to a massive renewed buildup in length. Part of that is probably also volatility has spiking, has moved higher. And when volatility goes up, then you as a hedge fund needs to lower your exposure because quite often you're targeting a certain level of volatility. And if volatility go up, then you need to reduce your overall exposure. But again, the upside, Eric, that's really where obviously things could get nasty if something develops.
If I'm reading this chart correctly, you're showing spare capacity presently as just over 6 million barrels a day. That's bigger than my mental estimate, which is definitely based on a lot less analysis than you're doing. Where is it that you believe that spare capacity is? Saudi Arabia has how much? UAE has how much? Where is that 6 million barrels?
Yeah, the bulk is Saudi 3 and UAE 1, and then two spread out. Kuwait got a couple of other smaller players have, but then it's spread out across the OPEC spectrum. But I can accept that maybe instead of calling it 6, that we call it closer to 4 or 5, because that these are UAE and Saudi Arabia are the only ones where we know for pretty certain that they can ramp up production at a relatively short period of time. And that's obviously what spare capacity is. It is the ability to increase production by that amount within a relatively short period of time. So we can argue that it may be closer to 4.
I think it's really important to understand that. And the reason is that, at least as I understand this geopolitical situation, and I'm the odd man out here, both you and Dr. Anas Al-Haji are both more qualified and more highly respected experts on this than I am. But the way I'm looking at this, Ola, is, look, we've got this situation where Israel has been very clear that they are going to invade Gaza. There's going to be some kind of ground invasion. They seem to be delaying that at the request of the United States, who wants to evacuate their civilians first. Okay, but it's coming. We know it's coming. Iran has pledged that if Israel does what Israel has pledged it's going to do, that Iran is going to retaliate. And it seems to me like there is very high risk that the U.S. gets involved with Israel in a war with Iran, which eventually escalates. And I think if you listen to what Senator Lindsey Graham said, I don't remember if it was Thursday or Friday of last week, he was just incredibly clear saying, look, if Iran does what they're promising to do, if Israel does what Israel is promising to do, then I'm promising right now that I'm going to introduce legislation to declare war and we're going to use military force, in Senator Graham's own words, to knock Iran out of the oil business, to use military force to destroy their oil-producing assets so that Iran can't produce or sell any more oil. I don't think that that's in the United States' interest, but obviously I'm not a senator and Mr. Graham is. If that happened, it seemed to me, if you take, I don't think anybody knows exactly how much oil is really being produced and exported from Iran because some of it is gray market. But if it was really all taken offline, I think that's at least 3 million barrels. And if we really have 6 million barrels of spare capacity, okay, that's one thing. But if we've only got 3.5 or 4, it's a very different story.
That's true. And again, that is the big unknown. I do note that last week when Biden visited Israel, he pleaded with the Israelis not to make the mistakes that they did after 9/11, that the U.S. did after 9/11. Obviously, the need for revenge and rage led to the ill-fought invasion of Afghanistan. Prior to that, we had Iraq. So obviously, the U.S. success rate in the Middle East when it comes to armed conflict has been extremely poor and has been extremely costly. So it really is ultimately a question of whether that the appetite for another incursion or another attack is there. I also do note that the U.S. from an oil demand perspective is no longer they are no longer a big customer of the Middle East. The big customers and the big interest in the Middle East from outside is China, a major buyer of crude oil not only from Iran but also the others. Russia is sending a lot of oil to the Middle East for refining, then being shipped back to Europe and elsewhere. And that basically means there's big forces and big nations involved there as well, which may act as a counter. So really, again, I'm not a geopolitical expert. I do note that in a worst case scenario, then $100 will not be capping the price. Then we'll be see it quite a significantly higher. But I think before we get to that, there'll be a lot of extra thoughts within the U.S., maybe the administration, just simply because they've done it before and they come out not looking good on both occasions. Let's see where it takes us. The spare capacity, absolutely correct. If we enter into such a situation, then that could be reduced fairly quickly. And then it doesn't really help much that we have proved ties with Venezuela, which has got the world's biggest known reserves, bigger than Saudi Arabia. Guyana is increasing production quite rapidly, and they could reach 1 million barrels next year. But that obviously is not happening. The timing-wise is not happening fast enough to alleviate or offset any risk there. So yeah, it's a big open question. It really depends on how many adults we have in the room, and many is just staring blind with rage at what's going on. So let's see.
Ola, let's move on to slide 12. What is the positioning from the Commitment of Traders reports telling us about what traders are doing in crude oil?
Yeah, well, what we've seen there, Eric, is quite interesting, that just simply the interest to get involved in this latest run-up in prices has not really been there. And generally, you can see the yellow line, which is a net position, if you take Brent and WTI combined, it has been on a bit of a downward sloping trend, but up until this year. And then we had these Saudi production cuts back in April. And since then, obviously, interest started to pick up. But as we failed above 90 recently, it just triggered quite a lot of selling. So the market is want to trade this market from a long perspective, but the conviction rate is, I would say, is fairly weak at this point.
Ola, moving on to slide 13, the chart we just looked at on page 12 actually was sourced from data in the government's Commitment of Traders report, which is kind of the oracle of data in the commodities world. The thing is, those government reports are incredibly difficult to read, and it's hard to really deduce exactly what they're telling you. You've done an absolutely amazing job of turning those government reports into a very visual graphic presentation, and what's more, you give it away for free. You don't even charge for it. So tell us how you got into this. I don't want to say the business, since you're not charging of it, but how'd you get into the business of giving away for free all of this wonderful visualization of Commitment of Traders data? And tell us a little bit more about why Commitment of Traders is so important.
Well, I think first and foremost, simply because if you're not a major trading house, you probably quite often feel that you don't have the same insights as they do. But what this report does is that it actually gives you a lot of information about what the big boys do. And basically, the Commitment Trade Report is basically all the positions, the open interest in the individual futures contract being broken into different groups, user groups. The biggest one that I tend to watch, and I'll tell you why, is the speculator interest. It's called managed money. It could be hedge funds, CTAs. I used to work for one in London for 8 years, and I know exactly how most of these they operate. They're looking for the big moves. They're looking for momentum. So they'll be buying into strength, and they'll be selling into weakness, quite opposite to what us mere mortals tend to do. We like to sell something that we think is too expensive and buy something that we think is cheap. Funds, hedge funds like momentum and trend-following funds, they'll do the opposite. And that's why often they get these really long and big rallies and big sell-offs, get a bit much better return on those. But what they do is, and quite often they've been I know the Saudi oil minister obviously hate them, but they are not starting moves. They're not meeting in a dark alleyway on a Friday afternoon to decide what to buy and sell in the days ahead. They anticipate, accelerate, and amplify price moves. They're not the ones necessarily starting them. Once a move has started, they will jump on board and accelerate and amplify it until, as I said, the music stops. And that's why quite often we'll find them being the longest at the turn lower and the biggest short when it moves higher. And that's just the nature of the beast. It's not because it's dumb money. It's simply because they've been enjoying the move up until that point. The table just gives you the rundown of the different markets. We talked about crude oil before, and you can see actually last week, quite interesting. WTI was net sold, where there was net buying of Brent. Brent is obviously the global benchmark, so that's where the geopolitical risk is concentrated. So that's why Brent was seeing a bit of a renaissance, and perhaps quite a lot of that was spreads getting out of WTI and into Brent instead. But I think the main move last week was really the gold market, where we had that massive increase in the net long from a short, and a lot of that was driven by short covering, which you can see, because quite often we just focus on the net, but it's most certainly interesting to break it down as well to see how does that net produced, and we can see that was quite a lot of short covering. So if this market is in a fresh bull run, then obviously 21,000 addition to the long side is not a lot, so you could potentially see continued short covering and additional lengths being added if this rally can get some additional traction to the upside. So so it just basically uses as my radar. You should as well. If you want to think about entering into a position, always be aware of the position, because it can give you support, some tailwind, or it can also be a bit of a hindrance if we are seeing any change in the direction.
Moving on to slide 14, we have to think about weather as we look at agricultural commodities. What's going on this page?
Yeah, just highlighting that this year is a bit of a strange one. We all worry about the availability of key crops at the start of the year with how is the weather going to play out. But the Northern Hemisphere has actually been fairly robust. We're seeing good production of the main crops, corn, wheat, and soybeans. Whereas the problems, and that's related to El Niño, is more on the Southern Hemisphere. And then also some of the reason why as we talked about earlier, that we've seen very, very strong rallies. And now I'm showing the one-year performance. As you can see, orange juice up more than 150%, sugar's up 75%, cocoa up more than 65%. And these are all related to supply worries and actual supply disruptions, because it's not as if food is not something where suddenly demand goes off a cliff, because I mean there's only so and so much food we can eat, we know how many animals are out there that need to be fed as well. So the volatility in the food market primarily comes from the supply side, and the supply is really where the market is somewhat worried. El Niño is going to have an impact this coming Northern Hemisphere winter, and this will continue to drive some of these the price action we're seeing. So a bit of a discrepancy between the key crops, the major crops, and some of the softs. A lot of that is related to El Niño.
And finally, on slide 15, you've got your equity theme basket. Now, tell me about what this actually is. Is this recommendations that you're making, or are you just giving an analysis of the market?
It's an analysis of the market, and also just get a better understanding for what's actually moving the equity markets, because we quite often tend to be just focusing on a specific indices, the S&P 500, the Nasdaq. We know roughly that Nasdaq is tech heavy and so on, but it doesn't really give you much of a nuanced picture. And this is obviously not rocket science, but a couple of years ago, for our own benefit and obviously for our clients as well, we created these different themes just to get a much more granular approach and then feeling for what's happening in the market. And we basically picked a number of stocks in the individual baskets, normally somewhere between 10 and 20, and use them to as a guide for what's happening. And this year already obviously has been quite significant in terms of movement. And some of them we all know about. We know the semiconductors with NVIDIA and so on. We know the cybersecurity is an ever-present theme that will continue to be important. Mega caps we know as well. And then obviously defense, given what's been going on. It seems like we're running out of ammunition, and defense industry is having a massive renaissance here. Then we got nuclear power, and then we got commodities down as well. Up 5.2%, still a relatively decent performance. And then again, the whole green transformation, which has really hit the rocks in recent months, simply because the cost of financing projects, very heavy commitments to financing, has had this negative impact on the green transformation and energy storage and renewable energy. So this is part of that is because the market has given up on, not given up, but basically some of these were, the themes were so strong that it's been bought to levels where some of these companies were struggling to deliver the returns that the market was looking for. And then adding to that sharply higher funding cost, and then you have at least in the short term, you have some sectors that are troubled. But generally, Eric, simply to give a better feeling for what it is that drives the market, and for us to make more qualified advice to our clients about where we want to be and in which sectors and so on. Because I'm not a stock market, I'm not an equity expert, but I do like themes. I can relate to those. And instead of you buying one particular stock in a particular theme, and then you have a problem with that individual stock, then it's obviously much better to spread your wings and buy a basket instead. So it's something that we are looking to expand as much as possible, because I think that is the future of equity investments.
Ola, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about how our listeners can follow your work at Saxo Bank. You've got your own podcast that you produce, and particularly, please tell them where they can find your free Commitment of Traders analysis reports.
Well, thank you for that, Eric. Well, obviously, if you are a client of Saxo Bank, you can everything is available on the platform. This is a snapshot from the platform that I show here on slide 15. But obviously, otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter. It's Oli underscore S underscore Hansen with an E. And I publish every Sunday, if I'm not too busy doing anything else on the weekend, I publish the tables and quick updates. Otherwise, you can always go on to analysis.saxo, where we post my updates and my colleagues who are focusing on equities, fixed income, and technical analysis and so on. So analysis.saxo is also a one-stop, one-shop go-to for all the stuff we do.
And what about the podcast?
We've changed the theme a little bit recently. Going forward, we are doing a commodity-specific podcast every Thursday. And again, I will always post it on my Twitter feed. But again, it can also be found on analysis.saxo. But the Thursday is primarily a commodity only, where we try to dig a little bit deeper than what we have been able to do in the past, where we try to come across all the different asset classes in a 15-minute talk, quite concentrated. But now it just gives us the opportunity to be a little bit more in-depth with the individual sectors. So Thursday, that's the day you can find my latest update.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Energy Transition Crisis, my new video documentary series about energy transition, has finally been released, and anyone can watch it for free at energytransitioncrisis.org. The series explains exactly what it's really going to take to break humanity's addiction to fossil fuels and why it will take longer and cost more than almost anyone realizes. And I'd like to think the three episodes on nuclear energy are among the most detailed on YouTube. This is a passion project for me, and there's no profit motive, no revenue, and therefore no budget other than donations. I'd really appreciate your help promoting the series. Things you can do to help include subscribing to the Energy Crisis Doc YouTube channel, liking every episode, posting comments on YouTube, and posting links to your favorite episodes on social media. If you don't have time to do those things, there's also a donations page at energytransitioncrisis.org. The money does not go to me. 100% of it will be spent on YouTube and other social media advertising to promote the series. Thanks in advance for your help. Now let's get back to the show and Patrick's post-game chart deck.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Oli Hansen back on the show. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Oli's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory data.
EIA printed a build of 1.4 million barrels on crude oil. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 213,000 barrels. Not a very big build, but hey, at least it's a build, and you know that's better than what we've seen recently. Gasoline drawing down only 156,000 barrels, so not a big deal. The only significant print on the board was the drawdown on distillates at 1.7 million barrels. U.S. production holding unchanged at 13.2 million barrels. The overall theme this week, up until late morning on Wednesday, was the market selling off because most traders have decided that the risk of the Israel conflict escalating to the point of affecting oil supply is negligible. Then the news hit the tape that Israel has agreed to delay its ground invasion of Gaza in order to give the United States time to move more missiles into the region to serve as a deterrent to further escalation. To my thinking, this was an obviously escalatory and therefore bullish event, but the market sold off hard on the news, bottoming at 82.08. Now that number is is fresh in my mind because it only missed my resting buy limit order at 82 spot 06 by two lousy ticks. So I missed my chance to lever up on the move before it predictably reversed. I had actually stepped away from my desk for a few minutes. By the time I came back, the whole thing was over. The big move down and then the retrace back up. From the initial tape bomb to well over a dollar down to the low at 82 spot 08, then a full retrace all the way back up to the price where the news first hit the tape took all of 12 minutes. But by the close, the market had rallied more than $3 off its lows to close above both the 55 and 13-day moving averages. Then it briefly retested the 5-day moving average at 85 spot 58 during the overnight session. I want to repeat and stress something I said in the feature interview, which is that both Dr. Anas Alhaji and Ola Hansen are far more experienced and widely respected experts than I'll ever be, and they both disagree with my very bullish oil market outlook, which is based almost entirely on geopolitical escalation risk, both in the Israel and Ukraine conflicts. That said, this feels to me just like February 2020. Lots of people smarter than me just couldn't see what I thought was obvious. So do I have it right again, or am I just paranoid? Because yes, I definitely admit I'm a very anti-war kind of guy. I'm probably more concerned and maybe even more paranoid about these geopolitical escalation risks than most other traders. So I'm going to line up quite a few dominoes to explain what I think could happen and why I think those risks just a bullish crude oil market view. Clearly, these are not predictions, these are just risks. Let's start with why Israel's commitment to delay their invasion to allow USA more time to move more firepower into the region was strongly bullish, not bearish, as the market first interpreted it. The Israeli people just went through something even more horrific than 9/11 was to Americans. Therefore, there's very strong military and public sentiment pressure for the IDF to take retaliatory action against Hamas. Military leaders are almost certainly frustrated by the delay because every minute they wait gives Hamas operatives more time to hide, escape, take hostages, or otherwise make themselves less vulnerable. So there's no way that Israel would ever agree to this delay unless there was some concession offered in return. Now, we can't possibly know what that concession was because it's a military secret. All we can do is speculate and guess as to what might be going on behind closed doors. To my thinking, a distinct possibility is that Israel made a deal with the U.S. Pentagon, effectively saying, okay, look, you want us to delay this invasion, so if we do that for you, what we want in return is a promise that if Iran attacks us, the United States will immediately unleash all of that newly arrived firepower on Iran. Remember that late last week, Senator Lindsey Graham said very directly that if Iran attacked Israel, USA would respond by using military force to, and these are his words, not mine, knock Iran out of the oil business by destroying their oil-producing and refining assets by force. Obviously, it's not in the United States' interest to take what I'm guessing is about 3 million barrels of oil production offline. We don't know the exact number because some of that is gray market and black market transactions. To take that supply offline at a time when the world is already running low on spare production capacity doesn't make any sense, but neither did draining the SPR as a war with a nuclear superpower was starting, and they still did that. We have no way of knowing what deal was struck between the United States and Israel to bring about this delay of the invasion, but we can easily deduce that the United States pledged some sort of additional military support to Israel in the event of escalation, and that's why this was a bullish market event, not a bearish market event. The stated U.S. strategy is that the two aircraft carrier battle groups and numerous guided missile destroyers and cruisers headed to the region are going there to serve as deterrents, not to enter a conflict. And as soon as they get there, Iran couldn't possibly dare to try attacking Israel because, obviously, they would never dare to take on the United States in a military conflict. I'm not sold at all on that logic. I actually think that this so-called deterrence could actually serve an aggravating rather than deterrent effect. But if I'm wrong and Iran backs down completely, then the market will trade lower for now, and I'll have been proven wrong on this particular call, at least in the short run. In the event that Iran strikes Israel in reaction to the ground invasion, which we know now is certain to happen, albeit after a delay, Israel, and probably the United States as well, will respond very aggressively and cause extreme damage to Iran, possibly taking all Iranian oil production offline. Now, if that happens and the U.S. and or Israel do attack Iran, Russia is likely to come to Iran's defense, and that could lead to direct hot warfare between the United States and Russia. If that happens, it's likely that it would immediately expand to both fronts, Israel and Ukraine. And in the very worst case, that could lead to a civilization-threatening thermonuclear conflict between the United States and Russia. And by the way, that phrase, civilization-threatening, was borrowed from Elon Musk, who opined this week that we are literally sleepwalking into World War III, and I very much agree with him. I just laid out quite a few dominoes in a row, so obviously these are not hard predictions. I'm just trying to emphasize all of the potential escalation vectors to explain why I'm so much more concerned about the risk of Iran escalation than either Ola Hansen or Dr. Anas Al-Haji are. And to be clear, if the deterrence strategy works and Iran backs down completely and doesn't retaliate for Israel's coming ground invasion of Gaza, then, okay, I was wrong and the oil market is probably all clear, at least from the Israel conflict, at least for now. I'm just a whole lot more skeptical than my more experienced peers are about how likely this strategy of deterrence is to work. I also don't rule out Iran striking Israel preemptively, even before any ground invasion begins. Let's all hope that I have this completely, totally wrong, and Anas and Ola have it right. I won't mind the big trading loss that I'll take as a result if it means that we averted the risk of a nuclear escalation with Russia, which I do think is a very real possibility right now.
So, Eric, on page 2, I just have a chart on crude oil. And, you know, obviously geopolitics, like you're suggesting, is going to be a big factor. But we had a very bullish impulse through August and September. And even before this escalation, we saw prices of crude oil trading up into the mid-90s. Now we're retracing and consolidating that move. The 200-day moving average just lies below $80. And one of the things I speculate is that even if we do have some short-term weakness, my first position is that that support line will hold and it will prove to being a buying opportunity. Obviously, the magnitude of the upside will have a lot to do with whether or not there's escalation in the situation like you were alluding to. But at minimum, I think that there's going to be an asymmetric buying opportunity to fade this back up into the 90s if it did get down toward the $80 area. So we'll keep a close eye on where those little turn points are. Nonetheless, let's move on to the equity markets. What's your position here, Eric?
The chart looks bearish with the 200-day moving average solidly taken out to the downside. But remember, the usual war cycle for equity markets is that the market tanks on the outbreak of a new war as people panic emotionally. Oh my gosh, a new war is breaking out. Sell everything. Then they remember that wars are always inflationary and the government will be spending hand over fist on armaments and the stock market rallies, usually led by defense stocks. So my best guess from here, if we do see a geopolitical escalation, is that the market would move sharply lower at first and then rally back toward its recent highs after the news of yet another new war has been digested emotionally by the trading community.
All right, I want to get Nick into this conversation. Let's just start off with getting the different levels based on the options markets. Nick, what are you watching here, bud?
Yeah, so right now the spot price on SPX is approximately 41.85. We have a call wall above at 4,300 and a put wall above as well, which broke yesterday at 4,200. The implied move for the November 17th monthly OPEX is plus minus 160 points. So the upper range would be 43.45 approximately. And the lower range would be 40.25, which is just above very key support of 4,000. Now we have resistance above now at 4,200 and support below at 4,150, 4,100, then that very key level of 4,000. I'm pretty surprised that we smashed so far below 4,200 already. Yesterday, you know, I thought we'd pin somewhere between 4,200 and 4,250 or so. And now looking at, you know, 4,185 area, it's possible we bleed out back to, you know, 4,150, but I do expect a short-term bounce back toward 4,250 before more downside. Again, seeing Meta earnings and Google earnings come out strong and watching both names fall heavily, that to me is a very bearish signal overall.
You know, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's interesting that you say that. First of all, on page four, I have the S&P 500 chart. And I just wanted to put that 200-day moving average. And the most important thing to highlight is that if you go back to the start of the 2022 bear market, once that 200-day moving average was violated, it began a one-year period where the market was essentially in bear market mode. And we now have officially broken below that 200-day moving average. Now, that in itself should not be a trigger point for a tactical trade, but it is more in the bigger picture, this idea that this market isn't holding key supports, but rather deteriorating through key levels. Now, we have an incredibly oversold market when you look at the broad market. So when you look at where the Russell 2000 is, where the S&P 500 equal weight index is, and what's held the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ up was those Magnificent Seven stocks. And just like you were saying what's happened on those earnings, you have a scenario where, well, if the Mag 7 start just some sort of a distribution cycle and investors start to rotate out of them, maybe into some of these incredibly beaten down value names that are offering extraordinary yields, if that kind of a rotation happens, these are such a huge weighting on these market cap weighted indices that maybe it is going to spur a little bit further distribution in this. And so that's one of the key things to watch. I think that while this sell-off up till now has already reached some very oversold levels, and even to me, the targets I use are all suggesting 4,100 as a logical place to look for a swing low. But sometimes when you have these spikes in volatility and participants kind of get spooked out, it creates an overshoot. And one of the questions I'm asking myself here is, even though this might be, you know, the seventh, eighth inning of this decline, is there going to be some serious volatility in the establishment of the bottom with some, a big kind of little washout move that really kind of knocks out some of these traders that have too tight of a stop loss? It's going to be really interesting. So on page five, Nick, you have that chart on the NASDAQ. Obviously, this is where the Mag 7 live. What's you watching here?
So spot price right now on the Qs is 347 approximately. We have a call wall above at 380, and we have a put wall below at 345. The implied move for the November 17th OPEX is plus minus 17 points. So the upper range would be 364 or so, and the lower range would be 330 or so. Key resistance right now is above at 355, then 360, and key support is just below at 340, then 330. And as you said previously, I do think we do get a bounce at some point because we are pretty heavily overextended to the downside. We're now down about almost 5% in the last week or so, which is a pretty substantial drop, for any market, right? And the thing that worries me again is seeing Meta and Google both report well and then decline. You know, Google's down over almost 10% yesterday, and Meta, as we speak, is down about 5%. The one that actually held up pretty well was Microsoft, and they had a strong report. They were still positive yesterday, but even so, it was a very muted move overall to the upside. So if we start seeing these names, as you said, fall down, like, you know, Google, Meta, NVIDIA as well has been faltering too. So those are three out of seven names that are already faltering. Apple's not looking very strong either, and Amazon reports tonight, so we'll need to see what Amazon does. But overall, it's hard to be bullish longer term. I do think we do get some short-term pops, and I will be playing those myself, but I won't be positioning for like long-term bull side.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't have the chart in the chart deck, but we were suggesting NVIDIA. And what's interesting about that is we're going to certainly have to wait deeper into November to get its earnings. But the price action has been very toppy ever since reaching back in June, July, this kind of 400 to 450 level. It's really been one big topping formation. And as a technician, it's very easy to call that like a head and shoulders topping formation. And if that became the pattern that's there, that $400 neckline where all of the lows that had been established in the summer lie, if the 400 level is given out with a breakdown, especially if it's accompanied by the rest, then I think that is going to spur some feedback selling that could be what drives a short-term breakdown in the NASDAQ. Boy, are we at an interesting moment. It'll be interesting to see whether or not these breaks happen this week and whether that spills into the S&P. Nick, though, on page 6, what I find fascinating is when we look at the volatility index, you would think in these types of market conditions that we would have seen already a spike north of 25 on the VIX. And here we are at 21, which is certainly substantially off of the 13 handle we were at during the summer. But the 21 level was the levels we were consolidating at the bottom end of the range throughout almost all of 2022. And, you know, in my mind, I'm almost asking the question, do we need to first see some sort of a market washout where the VIX is blowing through the upper boundary of 25 towards 30 in order to really bang out a swing low? It's certainly interesting that the VIX has not been as responsive as one would have thought in the light of the current condition. What do you make of the VIX?
So right now with the VIX at around 21, we should expect about 1.3% moves each day. What I think of it right now is that we're seeing a lot more selling in broad markets, which versus hedging for larger portfolios. So this is why I'm kind of inclined to think that we're seeing a more muted move to the downside. If you look at the S&P chart over the last couple of weeks, it's been a very gradual decline, even though we've fallen a fair bit in the last couple of weeks. You know, from a high of 43.90, we trickled down to 43.50, then 43.00, then we popped back up to 43.40, then it fell back down to 42.80 or so. It's been a very, very gradual decline. It hasn't been a very fearful decline like we saw in March of 2020, for example, right? So I'm not seeing a lot of hedging activity taking place. It's more so gradual selling, which means gradual decline to the downside and a lack of a spike in the VIX. Now moving on to page 7, we have the U.S. dollar index. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
We're still in the consolidation range between 105 and 107, on watch for an upside breakout, which would probably be coincident with a geopolitical escalation.
Yeah, well, Eric, I agree with that the geopolitical escalation is a factor, but the fact that we are seeing all of the central banks releasing their monetary policy statements within a week is, I think, going to play a big role as well. Bank of Canada just came out. We'll have the ECB just after the we're recording this, and we're going to then have Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and the FOMC next week. And I think that's going to play a role in determining whether or not the dollar at this point is technically looking like a flagging formation, which typically is a midpoint of a continuation pattern. And if in this weak period where we're in risk off, it typically is a play where the US dollar remains a safe haven asset. So a breakout above 107, I think, is the path of least resistance. And that certainly opens the window for a move to 109 to 1010. It'll be really interesting to see whether that continuation pattern plays out.
Moving on to page 8, we have the gold futures charts. What are your thoughts here, guys?
After the massive move up in the last 2 weeks, gold's slow stochastics are high and wobbly, signaling the risk of a pullback to retrace at least some of this gigantic one-way elevator ride straight up. But geopolitical risk will likely keep a bid under gold, at least for now. If the deterrent strategy works and there's no military conflict with Iran, that would likely bring a downside correction.
You know, it was an interesting observation that Ole made about the fact that it was driven by a short squeeze. And that really does fit the characteristics. The speed and velocity of gold moving to the upside shows those characteristics. The bigger question is, could we see a scenario where the typical intermarket relationship of the dollar rising being a headwind for gold decouples, and whether gold can actually rally in that environment? Now, what I would really be looking for here is when gold inevitably consolidates, that it stays well above 1900 and that works its way for a breakout above 2000. If that's the case, I agree with Ole's view that the upside would certainly be towards 22 to 2300 on the upside of a targeted move. I think the easiest thing for our listeners to do is simply watch the 2000 pivot. If gold can stay first of all, above 1900 during consolidations, and then makes the break above 2000, I really think that does open the window for that advance. And I think even though the previous highs are closer to 2100, I really think that the next test towards those highs will be broken on the upside. So it'll be interesting to see whether gold can finish that move. Now, moving on, I wanted to just touch on a few other charts. I have on page 9 the 2-year government bond in the U.S. And what's interesting here is obviously we've seen bond carnage, but the 2-year yield is very much influenced by Fed policy. And we've really seen that the selling has subsided in the 2-year bond, as it's clear that the Fed is moving towards, if not have already started, at least a pivot toward a pause. And then that really asks the question, are we witnessing the bottoms being formed on these 2-year bonds? And is it an opportunity to set up for what will maybe inevitably down the road be an easing cycle that will relatively impact these bonds with a bullish advance? This is certainly on my mind. Obviously, it's very premature. There's no technical reason to see that the 2-year is breaking out or something like this, but certainly it's establishing a support line that makes potentially buying it a limited risk. On page 10, I wanted to touch on that uranium, which this is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in Canadian dollars. And what we have is a clear breakout to a higher high. The uranium continues to be one of the hottest areas in the market. And this really does look like it's going to gun for the $28 to $30 area on the upside. It'd be really interesting to see whether that bullish leadership within the commodity basket continues here in the uranium. And the last chart I have on page 11 is copper. And I know that Ole was talking about copper and just how it is being currently priced. I still, though, think that this chart continues to demonstrate incredibly weak price action, making it vulnerable for potentially still even a trip back down to 2022 lows. Obviously, the big picture, there is a great bullish opportunity. And so any breakdown down to those kind of levels, I would view as an opportunity to position long-term on the upside of copper. But right now in the short term, very weak price action, and the most immediate risk to the downside is still there.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart ticks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In the Research Roundup email, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview. You will also find Ole Hansen's slide deck and the chart book we just discussed in the post game, including a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week. We'll be right back.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.